Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Well, I'm absolutely delighted that so many people have joined us this morning to address what is one of the most important of all decisions nationally and locally, and that is the election. It is, of course, a very important question that overlaps far beyond local or state questions. And in fact, at a time of financial crisis for the nation, the forces that exert pressures on the election are all the more important. Our Board of Overseers and I want to share the expertise of the university's world-class scholarship to address questions of this sort. Board of Overseers' role has been to assist the university in our outreach efforts, and we're pleased to convene this outreach activity this morning. I know that most of you are aware that U.S. News and World Report has consistently ranked UC San Diego, and in particular the Department of Political Science, among the top of public institutions in the nation. This is based on the strength of our highly regarded faculty, and I'm very proud of their service and willingness to participate in outreach activities such as this. And in a few moments, you'll be hearing from them as they describe for you the analysis they have about going into this election. We're fortunate to have as our moderator today our incoming chair of the Board of Overseers, Dan Eaton. Dan is a legal expert himself in the firm Seltzer, Kaplan, McMay, and Vitek. He's an expert in employment law, and he also is an excellent communicator. He has made commentary for Channel 6 and for KPBS. And I want to thank you, Dan, for coming today, for serving on the Board of Overseers, and for introducing our speakers and facilitating this morning's discussion.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chancellor Fox, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming for this very important gathering that we have here today in the midst of what is an historic election, actually. The Board of Overseers is very proud to join with you, Chancellor Fox, and your excellent staff in bringing the many stories of UC San Diego out to the community and to emphasize that we, the university community, is a resource to the media and the various other communities, and it's not just an oasis on the hill, to mix topographical metaphors. Before I introduce, I am now going to introduce each of our faculty members to give people a sense of the way this is going to work. Each faculty member will speak for about 5 minutes. After that, we will have about 30 minutes of question and answer so that folks can ask whatever questions they may have of our experts. The timing of this, of course, could not be better. To talk about the resources of UC San Diego and the scholars that we have at this school, I opened my door this morning and picked up my New York Times, the front page of the New York Times. There, the first story that caught my eye was "Quiet Political Shifts as More Blacks Are Elected," and right here it says that according to a study conducted by Zoltan L. Heinel, a political scientist at the University of California, San Diego, about 40% of Americans have lived in or near cities that have elected black officials. And I didn't realize that kind of timing came with my subscription, but I'm going to have to send them a thank you note. But the point of that, of course, is to make it clear that our world-class faculty do in fact have the expertise to serve as a resource to enrich the many stories that you are working on as we consider the impact of this election on San Diegans. All right, first to my immediate left is Professor Marisa Abajano, an authority on the Latino vote, and she will also discuss the women's vote in the coming election. One of our country's leading urban experts, Steve Erie, will comment on the San Diego City Council and the city attorney's races and will offer perspective on two city ballot issues on the proposed fire surcharge and the very contentious 10th Street port issue, as well as on political and economic effects of the general election on San Diego. Then we will turn to history professor Naomi Oreskes, who will focus on the potential impact of environmental and science policy issues on turnout and effect of voter attitudes. Then, of course, the aforementioned Professor Zoltan Heinel, whose highly regarded book, White Attitudes Toward Black Elected Officials, has been much discussed this year. And he will focus on this topic about changing white attitudes towards black political candidates, including the role of race in the presidential election and in San Diego and regional voting. Finally, one of the nation's leading authorities on California politics and elections, Professor Thad Kauser, has thoughts about the coattail effect on California of the national election and the national economy. Thad will also focus on state ballot initiatives, same-sex marriage, redistricting, and alternative energy. He will speculate on how high voter turnout might make San Diego a blue county for the first time in decades. Now, that's an awful lot to consider in a short time. Without further ado, let's start with you, Maria.
Great. Thank you. So I want to talk about two groups this election year and in years prior that have received considerable attention. That is the Latino electorate as well as women voters. I'll first start off with Latinos. Latinos over the past decade have received growing amounts of attention amongst politicians for two reasons. One is that they are the fastest growing demographic group in this country, now making 15% of the nation's population. So they're the largest minority group, outpacing African Americans. And second of all, Latinos are a highly coveted group amongst politicians because they are still what's considered to be up for grabs politically. So their alliances, unlike African Americans who have been strongly aligned with the Democratic Party, you know, Latinos, while traditionally have favored Democrats by a margin of about 60-40%, in the past election, George Bush was able to capture 40% of the Latino vote, which was the first time that any Republican presidential candidate was able to do so. So for these reasons, you know, every time the presidential election year comes, there's much attention devoted to Latinos. And it's not so much of their relative size, given that the way we elect presidents is through the Electoral College, it's where Latinos are concentrated. And so for this reason, in battleground states, two, for example, Colorado and Nevada, where there's a statistical dead heat right now, Latinos in those two states alone make up 20% of the population. Okay, so in these two states, which are critical for both candidates, Latinos have the potential to become the decisive vote. Outside of these two critical battleground states, Florida and New Mexico, which there's still a very small margin as well, you know, Latinos have, in New Mexico, they make up 40% of the population, in Nevada and Florida about 20%. Latinos there are key voters that politicians have been paying a lot of attention to. Now, the key to actually translating this electoral size into power is to actually get Latinos to turn out on Election Day. And for those, for scholars who study Latino politics, as well as for activists and community organizations as well, this is the key that they have to focus on, is getting Latinos to turn out on Election Day, because that is something that they notoriously haven't been very consistent doing. Mostly because many Latinos oftentimes are first-time voters, you know, meaning that the party doesn't necessarily think about them as likely voters, and so, you know, oftentimes it's left to grassroots organizations to get Latinos to try to get them to turn out on Election Day. And so for those reasons, the Latino vote is going to play, yet again, a very important role in this upcoming presidential election. For female voters, obviously, you know, with the candidacy of Hillary Clinton early on in the primaries, the female vote has received considerable attention this election year. And also with the vice presidential candidate, Sarah Palin, the focus on female voters has been considerable as well. And so given their important role, you know, many have speculated on whether or not females are going to be more likely to support a female voter simply because of this shared gender. You know, there have been some who speculated that it's the issues that matter, and so women tend to be more concerned about issues relating to the economy, to foreign and to terrorism, to national security. And so given the state of the economy at this moment, we can expect that women probably foresee that they're going to be voting more based on their issue preferences and their concerns, as opposed to, you know, a shared gender in with the candidates. So I'm going to pass it on to Steve
Erie. Professor Erie?
Thad, blue county, increasingly red city. What I mean by that is, if you look at the city attorney's race, and this is the backstory for the city attorney's race and the city council races, San Diego, if you look at voter registration, in the city and in the county has been trending Democratic. In fact, there's a Democratic plurality now in terms of voter registration in the city. But if you look at elected office holding, you know, the Democrats in the 1990s with district elections were the first to sort of figure out how to do that. And 5 or 6 years ago, there were, when we had 9 city council seats, there were 6 Democrats. We now have an incumbent, how long, we don't know, a Democratic city attorney. These may be nonpartisan races, but this is contested terrain. Understand, right, that San Diego is the last kind of Republican anchor project on the West Coast. All of the other cities have tipped from Republican to Democratic. Believe it or not, San Francisco was a Republican city. That was a Rockefeller Republican city up until 1960. Los Angeles was a Republican city. I grew up in Los Angeles, right, up until the election of Tom Bradley in 1973. You see it from Portland to Seattle to the Bay Area, but not San Diego. What's happened in San Diego is that the Democrats, in a sense, right, controlling a majority of the city council and being elected as city attorney, now find themselves, right, we're seeing, in a sense, the Republican counterattack. The mayor is very active in terms of embracing city council candidates like Phil Thalheimer. I mean, they're on the brochure in terms of his reform campaign. What we may wind up with on November 4th is a Republican mayor, a Republican city attorney, these are all nonpartisan supposedly, and a 4-4 tie on the city council. And it's ironic, given that maybe the county and the country, at least at this point, are trending Democratic, but the city of San Diego, partly because the Republican Party out-organizes, outspends, uses money from the building industry, from hotel tourist industry, for things like get out the vote, the absentee ballot. They've really sort of done much better than the Democrats over the last 5 or 6 years. So you may see this sort of counter trend in the city becoming a red city again, at least in terms of office holding, relative to the trends in the county and nationwide. Let me also talk about 2 propositions. One of them, I must tell you, I'm on the ballot, Truth in Advertising. Proposition B, this is the double decking of the marine terminal. I'm adamantly opposed to it for a whole bunch of reasons. We'll talk about that in a moment. But with Prop A, and I was actively involved with ex-Fire Chief Jeff Bowman's Regional Fire Safety Forum, trying to push for more firefighting resources, local resources in San Diego County. We're really seeing 2 stealth campaigns by the proponents. If you look at what it takes to pass a tax increase, a 2-thirds vote, and we're talking about a $52 per parcel and up tax for additional firefighting resources, not boots on the ground, Dan. I mean, this is equipment. This is not personnel, which is, I think, one of the reasons why organized labor has been so quiet on this issue. But if you look at the campaign, it takes normally $1 million to pass a countywide tax increase. And yet we have just the hint of a campaign without much spending, without much advertising in terms of Proposition A. So stay tuned on that. Proposition B, the proposed double decking of the Marine Terminal 10th Avenue. I must say that I think it's probably the most idiotic proposal I have ever seen on a local ballot.
Why don't you tell us now what you really think about it?
Yes. Yeah. From an engineering, we're on an active fault, you know, $1 billion, right, to build 40-foot high deck. We don't even know what the load structure, you know, engineers talk about, you've got to know what the load factor is. You've got to know what's going to be on top. Is it going to be a stadium? Is it going to be a hotel? Is it going to be a shopping mall? Stay tuned on this one. But the only people that seem to be supporting it are the sports reporters in the Union Tribune. And possibly the Sports Council. I mean, this, in a sense, right, is the Chargers' plan B. But given, I've never seen a coalition, this is like Napoleon's Grand Army, and I will conclude in just 1 second, against it. Every mayor of the 5 port cities, the entire city councils, their chambers of commerce, the environmental community, organized labor, the Secretary of the Navy, watchdog organizations like the Taxpayers Association and this week the League of Women Voters. I've never seen a coalition quite like this ever assembled in San Diego politics. But, you know, if this is the secret Chargers stealth plan, stay tuned in terms of the vote. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Professor Urey. Professor Oreskes, would you like to address the environmental issues and science issues that we're facing?
Sure, thank you. Well, one thing about sports fans, at least you know they stay awake. So I'm not a political scientist. I'm a historian, and I work on environmental issues. And I think environmental issues are a place where the historical perspective is really helpful to understanding what's transpiring, even if it doesn't necessarily tell us what to do about it. And I think this election in particular shows, it really illustrates how enormously difficult it is to get sustained political attention for environmental issues, and how we really see the gap between the time scale on which environmental issues develop and the time scale of the attention span and the staying awake of politicians and constituents. So global warming is a story with a long history, and it's a history that particularly resonates here in San Diego, because it was scientists here in San Diego at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography that played a key role in first really initiating sustained scientific attention more than 50 years ago, when Roger Revelle, Hans Suess, and Dave Keeling first predicted that global warming would happen and began to create a monitoring system for measuring CO2. And that history is continuous up to the present day with the recent fourth assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in which several faculty from UCSD played leading roles and shared in the Nobel Prize for that work. So we have a long history, more than 50 years of studying this question, and of course not just here in San Diego, by scientists all over the world. And scientists have told us that we do indeed now know that global warming is happening and that its primary cause is human activities, deforestation, and greenhouse gases. And we also know from polls that most Americans now understand this, at least even if they don't understand all the details of the science, they do understand the basic idea. The Yale Project on Climate Change, working together with the Gallup and Clear Vision polling organizations last summer, found that 62% of Americans believe that life on Earth will continue without major disruptions only if society takes immediate and drastic action to reduce global warming. So that sounds like something that ought to be an election issue, drastic and immediate action. I mean, how often do you even find the electorate or anybody agreeing that we need drastic and immediate action? So it sounds like something that a significant majority of the American people understand and care about, and yet, if you've been watching the election, which I assume everyone in this room has, you've noticed that it's scarcely even been mentioned in this election cycle. And other environmental issues, like the state of the oceans, biodiversity loss, water around the globe, have virtually vanished from discussion. Virtually no discussion of any of these issues at all. So what's going on, and maybe the political scientists here can explain this better than I can, I just observe it as a historian. An obvious answer, of course, is the war and the economy have drowned out all other issues. But even before the distressing and worrisome events of the last 2 weeks, there was very, very little discussion in the election, even in the primaries, very little discussion about the issue. And even in the primaries, where there were candidates who had quite different positions about global warming, there was almost no discussion. So it would appear, at least on the surface, that this is not an issue that politicians think will gain them votes, at least not on the national level. It may be different on the state and local level. And one thing I think that we have seen very clearly in recent years, and what this speaks to, is a very significant change that has happened in the American political scene over the last 20 to 25 years, which is a deep, deep polarization on environmental issues, a polarization that did not exist before. So this is a huge change historically. If we go back to 1964, when the Wilderness Act was signed into law by President Lyndon Johnson, that law passed the Senate by a vote of 73 to 12, and it passed the House of Representatives by a vote of 373 to 1. I'm still trying to find out who the one was on that one.
That one.
Yeah, that one, right. Yeah. You know, this is staggering. It's impossible to even imagine an environmental bill today that could gather that kind of bipartisan support, right? I mean, it's just inconceivable. So something has really changed dramatically since 1964. Or even since 1970, when President Richard Nixon, who's not generally remembered as a great environmentalist, created the Environmental Protection Act and signed into law the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, all kinds of other important environmental legislation, or even 1992, when President George H.W. Bush signed the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And actually, 1992 is really a pivotal year historically, because it's just around there when the bipartisan coalition actually begins to break down. It's one of the things I've been studying, is what happened in the first Bush administration over the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. But many people have forgotten that the United States is a signatory to the UN Framework Convention, which commits us to taking action to preventing dangerous anthropogenic interference in the climate system, and that was signed by our first President Bush. So what we see is that for roughly 30 years, from the early 60s, really the late 50s, because the Wilderness Act was really lobbied for in the late 50s, but so from the late 50s up until the very early 1990s, both Republicans and Democrats supported environmental protection, even if they disagreed about how extensive those protections should be, precisely what form they should take, or how they should be enforced. The agreement about the goals was there, even if there was disagreement about some of the means to those ends. But this has really changed since the mid-1990s, when Democrats and Republicans have split dramatically and harshly on environmental issues, with Republicans not just working to loosen many regulations that were previously put in place even during Republican administrations, but in many cases doubting and challenging the science on which those policies have been based. And this speaks to another polarization that has developed, which again, polls clearly show that if you ask the American people their opinions on global warmings, Democrats and independents overwhelmingly accept the reality of global warming, whereas Republicans, including Republicans in the U.S. Congress, still say that they think there are significant doubts about whether it's even happening, or as we've seen with our vice presidential candidate on one side, doubting whether humans are the cause of it. So we see a situation now where the polarization is extremely deep, extremely profound, and which there are a lot of misconceptions that can't be easily addressed in a soundbite, misconceptions that I think cannot be easily addressed in a debate, although Joe Biden certainly tried the other night. And we see a situation where even John McCain, who at one time was a leader among Republicans on global warming, co-sponsored the McCain-Lieberman Act, now seems to have nothing whatsoever to say on the issue.
Thank you very much, Professor Oreskes. Obviously, while environmental issues have been off to the side, energy issues, which some see as related to environmental issues, have increasingly come to the forefront. Professor Heinl, whose book, White Attitudes Towards Black Elected Officials, was so prescient that it didn't even focus on Barack Obama because of the speed, he tells me, with which the academic press works. So it'll be very interesting, given his exquisite timing, to hear what he has to say about the phenomenon that we are all witnessing here in 2008. Professor Heinl?
Well, I'll just be a typical academic and extrapolate from my data that doesn't pertain to the actual case. So one of the biggest questions surrounding this election is simply, is America ready for a black president? And I won't purport to have the definitive clear answer to that question, but I do think there are a number of interesting and promising signs. So one of the biggest trends in American politics over the last 50 years or so has been the growth of minority elected officials all across the country. We now have about 10,000 African Americans in elected office around the country. Believe it or not, about 40% of Americans live in a metropolitan area that's had a black mayor or in a state that's had a black governor. So I believe, and I argue in my book, that this widespread experience with black leadership has had consequences. And the consequence is it's sort of lessened white fears about black leadership and then perhaps about other minority leadership. So if we go back to the 1960s when the first black challengers were running for mayor and other positions, they faced almost overwhelming white opposition. There was a lot of fear. So, for example, when Tom Bradley ran to become mayor of L.A., there was fear that the police force would quit en masse. There was fear that there'd be racial integration of white neighborhoods. And in response, there was tremendous white mobilization across these cities and oftentimes very racist campaigns. So in Newark, for example, the slogan one of the candidates, white candidate, asked, or stated, whether we survive or cease to exist depends upon what you do on election day. In Atlanta, the slogan was simply, Atlanta is too young to die. But many of these African-American candidates did get elected, as I've said. What's interesting is what didn't happen after they were elected. There was no radical pro-black agenda. The world under black leadership was strikingly similar to the previous world under white leadership. And I make the argument, and I think there's now evidence that that experience lessened the fears of many white Americans. So if we look at electoral results in the 60s, something like 83% of white voters voted against these successful black mayoral challengers. Every decade since then, more and more white voters have been willing to support black challengers, and the proportion, while not a majority, has doubled. So in the 1990s, 34% of white Americans were supporting black mayoral challengers in large cities. That's the positive story. There is obviously some ongoing evidence of white resistance or resistance. So if we, in national polls, ask white Americans about African Americans, many still hold serious stereotypes about African Americans. So they believe that on average, African Americans are less intelligent, more prone to welfare, more prone to violence. Some large proportion of Americans. In experiments, whites tend to rate a fictional black candidate as less able on several different dimensions than a similar fictional white candidate. If we also go back and look at the primary, there's I think more evidence that race mattered, at least on the margin. So in polls in a number of states, about one in five white voters said that race was a factor in their choice, in their decision. And if we look across states, white support for Obama was lower in states with large African-American populations than it was in other kinds of states. So some mixed evidence. What do things look like now moving forward? In national polls, a little over 40% of white Americans say they will support Barack Obama in the national election. To me, that means that race actually still matters on the margin. Obama's white support now is a little less, about 5% less, than the typical white Democratic nominee for president would get, say, Kerry, Gore, other recent white Democratic nominees. You add to that the fact that Obama is in an incredibly strong position. We have a very unpopular Republican incumbent. You have an economy that's faltering, if maybe a little bit on the upsurge now. And you have an unpopular war. So you would think that Obama would do significantly better among white voters than previous white Democratic nominees. He's doing a little bit worse. So that suggests, I think, that race will be a factor. On the other hand, the bigger picture is, I think, it's very likely he will win unless something dramatic happens. And that's largely because of sort of lessening white fear and strong minority support. So Obama has overwhelming black support. We're expecting very high black turnout. Obama's doing well among Asian Americans, who are favoring him about 2-1. And he's also doing well, as Marissa indicated, among Latinos, who are also favoring him about 2-1. So he will likely lose some white votes because of race, but that will be more than compensated for by sort of exceptional minority support in this election. The other thing I just wanted to briefly mention is, if we look at the local picture, one of the things that I think is the most significant trends that explains in part some of the things Steve was saying about trends is that in the county and a little bit in the city, the biggest trend is really the growing Latino population. So since 2000, the Latino population of the county has grown more than 17%. That growing Latino population is overwhelmingly Mexican in origin, and it's largely Democratic. So we are shifting more and more towards the left. And Steve is absolutely right that hasn't changed outcomes all that much yet. And Marissa's right because of the underparticipation of Latinos. But the numbers are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And even with Latinos underparticipating, as their overall size grows, they are inevitably going to have a bigger impact. And while so the short term is, we may get some pro-Republican outcomes. It looks in the long term, with growing immigration, continuing immigration, that we are moving to the left and will stay to the left over the long term.
Which brings us to a perfect segue to Professor Kauser, who is an expert on California elections and politics, who can talk more about this emerging demographic. Professor Kauser?
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Over the past generation, California has undergone a series of political transformations. We've moved from a state divided largely along north-south lines to one divided along east-west lines, with a more liberal, democratic-leaning coastal area and more conservative suburbs. We've moved from a state that was reliably red in presidential and many statewide elections. This was a big part of the Nixon, the Reagan, even George Bush, George H.W. Bush in 1988, his coalition, to a state that is now so blue that the major parties just haven't contested this in the last two presidential campaigns. Finally, we've moved from a state where the Democratic Party used to be internally divided between more conservative, law and order Democrats in the Central Valley, many of whom had Oklahoma and Texas political roots, versus urban Democrats in Los Angeles and San Francisco who are much more liberal, to a state where now the internal political divide is between Republicans who are along in the coastal suburbs, very often fiscal conservatives but social moderates, especially on issues like abortion, who are often clashing with Republicans in the exurbs of California, in the Central Valley and in the mountain regions, who are often tied to evangelical churches and much more socially conservative. All of these changes are interrelated, and they all have something to do with the political transformation of San Diego, which is moving from a generation ago, a reliably conservative red county, to what's now one of the state's most closely contested political battlegrounds. It may glow blue in this election. It may not. That will only be a signal of what's going on in San Diego and what, in fact, has occurred where we are now. This is a close city and county, whereas a generation ago it wasn't. So how's this happened in San Diego? Well, the story is about economics, about demographics, and about political change. First, many Republican voters in San Diego have moved to other parts of the state and to other states and been replaced by more liberal voters. Second, the National Republican Party has moved to the right on the ideological spectrum compared to where the remaining San Diego Republicans, a majority of them, are. So let me break these down one by one. 30 years ago, in the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, much of the Republican base in San Diego was white-collar and blue-collar workers who were tied to the defense industry, folks who made rockets and airplanes, folks who helped the nation win the Cold War, and as a reward, often lost their jobs. Many of these voters moved to Phoenix, to Las Vegas, to Fresno, to Temecula, and a lot of Republican voters either left the state or left the coastal areas of San Diego. They've been replaced largely by Latinos, who are leaning in ever-increasing numbers in California towards the Democratic Party, and by high-tech workers in the biotech industry, who are much more in the middle of the political spectrum, but especially moderate to liberal on social issues. So that's created a situation where national Republican candidates who are on the right, especially on social issues, as all of the Republican presidential nominees have been in recent years, have found San Diego tougher and tougher going on the electoral map. We've seen a lot of signs of this change. So first, in 1992, Bill Clinton actually won a plurality of votes in San Diego. That had a lot to do with Ross Perot being in the race, and it wasn't. So no Republican has won a majority in San Diego. This could be the first year that no Democratic candidate has won a majority in San Diego. This could be the year that happens. There are a few signals of this. One is the trend in party registration, the percent of San Diegans who ally with the Democratic Party rather than the Republican Party. It's now almost even between the two parties, whereas in 2004, Democrats were about 70,000 voters behind in the county of San Diego. The city of San Diego, Democratic registration now outstrips Republicans by about 10 percentage points. There's been a lot of changes in many of San Diego's suburbs. Del Mar now has more registered Democrats than Republicans. This is apparently the new Berkeley of San Diego, Del Mar. So this change is important, but it's not everything. All right? Another trend is we've seen a lot more interest on the part of Democrats in this presidential race than on the part of Republicans in San Diego. So we've seen at college campus every day I see voter registration drives. The youth vote could make a difference in this election, and it's been on the rise in the last few presidential contests. But the other sign is in the the presidential primary this year, 70,000 more people took part in the Democratic presidential primary than the Republican presidential primary, even though both of them were up for grabs. That there were in 2004, there were far more Republicans taking part than in their primary than the Democratic primary, even though George Bush had things sewed up. So that is a big signal of change. But this race really will be decided by the nearly 1 in 4 San Diegans who aren't part of a major party. Right, 23-24% of San Diegans are now registered as declined estate voters. They're registered with a minor party. And those are going to be the swing voters who are going to tip San Diego one way or another in this election and in the years to come. Those voters right now are trending clearly for Barack Obama in the state of California. We may see a change in this. The campaign's not over. John McCain, the risk taker, may try to jump the shark again. We may see another move like the Sarah Palin move, like the call for a suspension of the campaign. We may see another dramatic move that shifts independents into his column. If that doesn't happen, San Diego will likely go blue on a county level in this race for the first time in a generation.
Thank you very much, Professor Kauser. What struck me in listening to all five of the panelists was diversity of the perspectives. I mean, you had historians, political scientists, and so forth. And it just reinforces the remarkable range of resources that we have here at University of California in San Diego that's available to the media, local, state, and national. I would like to acknowledge that there are a number of members of the Board of Overseers here with us today, which again reinforces the importance that we place on outreach, that we are making a big focus this year on bringing the stories of University of California, San Diego to the broader community. At this point, I'd like to open it up, however, to questions for our panelists. Are there any questions that anybody has for our panelists? I actually have one just to get things started. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Good. Oh, good. Jesse, go ahead.
Can any of you give a comment on the impacts of the redistricting proposition, what that means, if it passes?
Sure, and my conflict of interest that I'll reveal here is I'm on the board of California Common Cause, which has been a major force behind this initiative. If Proposition 11 passes, an apparent conflict of interest in the way districts are drawn in California, where legislators are drawing their own district lines, will be removed. Now, will that lead to a major change in what our districts look like? It's unclear, right? California's legislative districts have been increasingly polarized. There are safe Democratic seats and safe Republican seats. But a lot of research shows that doesn't have much to do with who draws the lines. That has a lot to do with where Californians choose to live. So Californians right now, Democrats are much more likely to live near other Democrats. Republicans more likely to live near other Republicans. And this political segregation that we've seen increase over the past 10 or 20 years has more to do with sort of economic trends and where people want to live for other reasons. But it means that it's very hard to draw a Democratic district, a Republican or a competitive district into the San Francisco Bay Area. It's going to be hard to draw a competitive district in the Sierras or in the Central Valley instead of one that's leaning Republican. So I won't predict a giant change in our politics, but the process could look a lot less conflicted.
Professor Erie, do you have anything to say about this?
No, not on that, no.
Okay. Is that going to pass? I mean, there have been similar propositions on the ballot before that have failed.
Three others have failed, but they didn't come at a time when the legislature's approval ratings were in historically low levels even before this long budget
okay.
mess that we've had. So I think that bodes well for it.
Thank you. Go ahead. John, go ahead. And then Richard. John? Richard, go ahead. It's on. And then we'll go to you, John.
First of all, let me just tell you that your presentations were all excellent. Thank you very much to open that way. The question I have for any or all of you would be if you could talk a little bit about the impact of the 24/7 television and immediate coverage that's faster than ever, and on the internet, which has been introduced more so the last two election cycles. Hear that, and on the youth vote, that's one of you mentioned, maybe coming into fruition for the first time and having a great impact, especially in the Obama factor.
Who wants to take that? There were three different questions there, obviously. Why don't we start with the youth vote, because we haven't really talked about it, and it's one that university people are uniquely qualified to discuss. Professor Erie?
Actually, I'm a policy person much more than a politics and campaign person. So if we can sort of defer...
I'm sorry. I just keep doing that to you, don't I?
I know.
It's sort of karma for all you do to your students, I suspect. But Thad, do you want to try to take it?
Mea culpa.
Or Professor Heimel?
Go ahead and
Well, youth turnout grew from 2000 to 2004, and the Obama campaign... Sorry, MTV's Rock the Vote has... registered about 2.5 million new voters in this election. Question is whether these folks' registration is going to be current in the fall and whether they turn out to vote. I think this campaign has as good a chance as any. And the Obama campaign, but also the John McCain campaign, have been especially good at using text messaging to get out the vote and using the tools of new technology that even my generation has no idea how to use. So we'll see.
Professor Heidel?
Yeah, I mean, I would actually add to that we're maybe overemphasizing the youth vote. So 2.5 new million voters is not actually that large when you look at the number of total voters in the nation. So
well, it depends on where they are.
Right? It depends on where they are. It depends on how strongly they favor one candidate or the other. So I would just sort of caution us: it's an interesting phenomenon. It hasn't proven to have mattered in past elections. It may not matter in this election. With regard to the internet and cable, I think having so many distinct avenues to collect our political information has probably, and I don't have data on this, but has probably led to has been a contributing factor to the polarization that we have in this nation. So you can watch Fox and you can hear that Obama did poorly in the debate. You can watch PBS and hear that Obama did well in the debate. And you don't get the same mix of views that you might have gotten 10, 20, 30 years ago. The other thing I would say about the amazing access we have to this election is that it may not mean that we actually, as Americans, are that much more informed than we were in the past. I haven't seen recent polls, but typically, amazingly enough, Americans... In the past, haven't known what the candidates stand for on a number of issues. They've been woefully a large chunk of Americans have been woefully ignorant, and I don't know if I've seen any evidence to indicate that we're now more informed than we were before. So we're hearing a lot more, but whether we're actually getting information, and you see that a little bit in terms of the number of undecided voters out there. So. It's not a huge number, but there, you know, you would think that given how much data is out there, that everyone would have decided already. But amazingly, many people are not paying attention to this election at all and are undecided.
Professor Abahanyo, is there a generational difference in voter participation among younger Latino voters and those who are older?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How?
I mean, amongst the 18 to 34,
yeah.
There's much lower turnout amongst... And I think this is true not just for—I mean, this is particularly problematic for minorities, but for the general electorate as well. That there are these large gaps in turnout and participation.
Okay, Richard, you had other aspects of your question. Professor Oreskes, you talked about the environment and how it's been overlooked, and yet energy has gotten some attention. Have you looked at that whole issue of energy and the extent to which that has drawn some of the attention of the political candidates and the impact it has had on the policy debate?
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, I've followed energy issues forever because I'm a geologist by training. Yeah, it's, to me, really depressing because it would seem like energy would be the one place where it would be easiest to engage the environmental issues because there's such a fantastic a fortiori argument that can be made about fossil fuels, that it's bad that we depend on fossil fuels on so many levels. It's bad from the point of view of foreign policy. It's bad from the point of view of the economy and jobs. It's bad from the point of view of the environment. So you would think that it might be possible, you know, to wrap those things together and say, hey, all of these things work together to tell us that we need a comprehensive energy strategy that moves us away from fossil fuels and towards alternative energy sources that can be developed as domestic sources that create jobs, protect the environment, generate, you know, economic growth. That would have seemed to me to be a no-brainer argument. And yet, somehow, I mean, you've heard a little bit of that, but not very much. And instead, you know, you're seeing this, we need to drill offshore, which will have absolutely no impact on the price of gas. So, you know, this seems to me to be like one of the most depressing examples of politicians on all sides scrambling to present a short-term, or what might appear to be a short-term solution to an immediate problem, the price of gas at the pumps, a solution that will not, in fact, solve the immediate problem and which would make the long-term problems worse. So that's depressing. But I don't know what to say about it, except that that's an observation that I have.
Yeah, sure. Please. John, I'm sorry.
Yes. First, I'd like to compliment all of you on the substance of your presentations. Professor Hanal, I have a concern in terms of what you brought forth. I noticed that you talked about the white vote and its reaction to Obama, but I think it's equally important to discuss the African-American vote and its reaction. And I think it's important to identify that he is not your typical African-American candidate, being of mixed parentage and international influence. And I think it's also important from a historical standpoint for people to understand that African-Americans have held significant offices going back to being senators and lieutenant governors before the Reconstruction. I'm the descendant of the first African-American congressman from North Carolina. And I think it's important that those things be put in perspective. And I think you have to do that. So as your research dealt with the African-American response to McCain as well as Obama, as opposed to just how marginal whites feel about Obama?
Well, in fairness, his research really didn't focus on Obama at all. So I want to be fair to him, because you're putting him on the hot spot, and certainly maybe his ongoing research might. But it is a fair point. Has your research focused at all on black reaction to different kinds of black candidates, including Obama?
Yeah. So Obama is a very interesting case because he's not a quote-unquote typical black leader. And originally, when the primaries began, there was a big question as to whether African Americans would support Obama. And the early polls suggested that they would not, or at least that they were certainly in favor of Clinton by large margins. And most, or at least a slim majority of African American leaders were supportive of Clinton. And there's lots of reasons for that. The Clintons were very popular with African Americans, did a lot for African Americans at different points in time. I, tooting my own horn, predicted very early in the campaign, based nothing on about Obama, but based on previous experience, that Obama would get the vast majority of the African American vote.
And if you put yourself out on a limb, did you?
Right. It's even in print. It's in print. It's in the Wall Street Journal. So you can go back. But the reason for that is if you look historically at other African American candidates, in almost any kind of context, be it a Democratic primary or a general election, African Americans have been incredibly supportive of black candidates. Again, Obama was somewhat unique, but you look at elections in big cities, elections for city council, there's been solid support for African-American candidates, with the exceptions of black Republican candidates, who by and large get almost no African-American support. So unless you're a Republican, which obviously Obama is not, you tend to get, and especially in a sort of historic case like this, there is still, I think, so there's still some fear among whites, there's still some hope among African-American voters that this will bring about significant change. That, interestingly enough, the story that I told about white fears is mirrored in the African-American community. So in the 1960s, African-Americans mobilized in unheard of numbers to support these black candidates for mayor. They won, and over time, you saw, when the world didn't change, you saw some disappointment within the African-American community, and you saw declines in turnout over the decades. And so when there's a new African-American challenging to be the first mayor of a new city, you don't get quite the same level of excitement and turnout as you used to, because I think both whites and blacks in America are realizing that the skin color of a candidate is not going to dramatically change what goes on. There's other power structures. One mayor is not going to make a difference. One president is probably not going to be able to change the way we view race and race relations and the inequalities that we have in America. And I think both whites and African Americans are now more aware of that than they were before.
Mr. Carlos?
Yeah, with the Voice of San Diego. We've heard you talk a couple of times about the Obama surge. how realistic is that, and how would, if it really does exist as a phenomenon and it's going to really make an impact on election day, I'm interested to know how that might affect the local races, and I'm particularly interested in the city attorney's race.
Great. Who wants to take that? Well, Professor Aaron?
Now I can take it.
All right.
Look, the Democrats, the Republicans are outspending the Democrats 4 and 5 to 1 over the last couple of city elections. The Democrats are praying for the so-called Obama surge. In other words, to try to make this as partisan a race as possible, to capture, right, that, you notice I use the word surge, to capture that possibility. That's the wild card, Will, I think, in the city elections. Everything else being equal, as I said, it looks like the Republicans are going to capture the city attorney. It's going to be a 4-4 tie on the city council. In other words, we move back at least temporarily, not long term perhaps, but temporarily, right, as a Republican city in terms of elected office holders. That's the $64,000 question, I think, in November. And that's what the Democrats are counting on.
And just to follow up on that, you have 5 Republicans who are sitting on the County Board of Supervisors, and yet you say that we are moving towards a blue county. How do you square all of that? Well,
that's because of the 2 Republican parties that we have, right?
Okay.
So you have the flexibility, if you're a local politician, to define yourself in a way that makes sense to the voters locally. And the 5 Republicans on the County Board of Supervisors certainly have. And, you know, a Jerry Sanders Republican is much more like a Pete Wilson Republican than like the Republican nominees we've seen at the national level. And that tailoring ability is part of what, you know, what has led to Republican success. On the search question,
yeah.
The lesson from the primaries is that Senator Obama did very well with and brought lots of new voters in places where you could put lots of foot soldiers on the ground to knock on the doors and drag them to the polls. So he did very well in Iowa, but it did much worse than predicted in California, where he didn't have that kind of grassroots effort. There's not going to be in San Diego a huge Obama campaign just because California is so solidly in the blue column. All the Obama precinct captains are going out to Las Vegas, to Reno from California. Without that ground mobilization, I don't think we'll see the Obama surge in San Diego and its coattails.
Yeah, go ahead. Matt.
Hi, Liz Malloy from the Daily Transcript. I was wondering, in the last election, 2004, the gay marriage vote really caused a pretty big surge in conservative voters. I was wondering if you're predicting any effect on that in California. Maybe not enough to turn the state red, but maybe sway a couple counties.
Prop 22 versus Prop 8, basically, yes. Is what your question is. Do you want to take that down?
Sure. I think certainly Proposition 8 is generated a tremendous amount of excitement in the conservative-leading faith community. That's going to turn out a lot of voters. I don't think right now that's going to be enough to pass Proposition 8. I don't think right now that, combined with Sarah Palin's candidacy, is going to be enough to turn the state for John McCain. I do think it may push the parental notification of abortion initiative into the win column. That's been very close in recent elections, and it's closely supported by people motivated by Sarah Palin and by Proposition 8.
That's Proposition 4. You already used a rhyme on KVBS, 48 hours more, just because there's a dozen of these things. But we are in the middle of fire season, and that's going to have an impact on the policy shape. Obviously, we know, because there's something going on at Camp Pendleton. Professor Erie, would you like to address some of the policy issues that are raised that we are facing right in the middle of fire season as we get ready to go to the polls?
We are probably the most fire-threatened region in California, and we are the most locally under-resourced region in terms of fire protection. Proposition A moves us a little way. I don't call it a halfway measure. I call it a quarter-way measure in terms of additional equipment parsed out to existing agencies and at least the potential creation, right, of a regional fire authority. But, you know, San Diego is so different from Orange County and Los Angeles in terms of how it's prepared and how it spends for fire. Orange County, a county fire authority. Los Angeles, the county fire department with a budget of $900 million. LA County spends 100 times what San Diego County spends on for that is county to county on fire protection. You know, we're a little better off. We've got the super scoopers. We've got a couple of leases. We've got the potential right. Military aerial firefighting resources, using helicopters at night. So equipment-wise and in terms of the aerial battle, we're a little better off than we were last year. But in terms of boots on the ground, in terms of fire personnel, we're in no better shape. And do understand that there are two Santa Ana seasons, Dan. This is the L.A. Santa Ana season, not the San Diego Santa Ana season. What I mean by this is that the high is well above Four Corners, and the wind pattern at this point in time is moving counterclockwise, and it's hitting with the worst winds, the highest velocity winds, Los Angeles County. And you're seeing what's happening up there. What will happen over the next week or two is as that high moves down to Four Corners, the wind pattern will turn clockwise, and that's the danger season for San Diego. Yes, we're slightly better off, but we have a long ways to go. Look, San Diego County, apples to apples comparison with Los Angeles County in terms of all of the local agencies, spends less than 40% per capita of what L.A. County spends on firefighting. This should be a number one issue. Proposition A starts to address it, but as I said, it's really sort of a quarter of the way measure in terms of what this county needs with respect to local protection.
Thank you, Professor Erie, and thank you all of our panelists. I want to thank all of you for coming, my colleagues on the Board of Overseers, our distinguished panelists, members of the media. I hope after this roughly 1 hour that we've had together, you are a better informed voter. I know I certainly am. Our panelists will be available for further interchange, but for now, thank you and have a good day.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.